Welcome to the CSIS Cogitasia podcast, where we think deeply and reflect on policy in Asia. I'm Colin Quinn. We'll start as we always do with the region's news. Citing the terrorist threat to Japanese citizens abroad, the parties of Japan's ruling coalition will debate on whether to reduce limits on the use of force to allow Japan's self-defense force to mount hostage rescue operations. Prime Minister Shinzo Abe opened his major policy address to the Diet on February 12th by discussing this topic, which comes after the execution of two Japanese citizens by ISIS. Over the weekend, North Korea successfully tested five anti-ship cruise missiles, reminding the region of the threat to vessels operating around the Korean Peninsula. South Korean President Park Geun-hye's third nominee for the post of Prime Minister received a scathing reception from opposition parties in the National Assembly on February 10th, leading to doubts as to whether Lee Won-koo will be confirmed. A manuscript released at Lee's confirmation hearing disclosing comments he made on January 27th about pressuring editors and shaping journalists' career advancement have undermined his candidacy. The United States Trade Representative filed a new WTO case targeting Chinese subsidies to exporters in seven sectors this week. U.S. Trade Representative Mike Froman said Chinese local officials have been allowed to subsidize smaller exporters through common service platforms at nearly 200 demonstration bases throughout China. Meanwhile, President Xi Jinping has accepted an invite from President Obama to make his first state visit to the United States in September. In India, the Aam Aadmi Party crushed political rivals BJP in Delhi's local assembly elections, winning over 96% of the seats, once again demonstrating the power of India's local parties. Lawmakers said this week that Myanmar's President Thein Sein has given the green light to holding a referendum on amendments to the country's military-drafted constitution sometime this year. Myanmar is due to hold a general election late in 2015. The G20's latest ministerial communique highlighted that although oil prices dropping is good for consumers, the global growth outlook remains disappointing. The note also signaled that the window for the US Congress to pass IMF quota reforms is closing and that options outside of congressional channels are being considered. The outcome for quota reforms agreed back in 2010 will have implications for Asia as competition over regional economic architecture heats up. And that's the news. Now we turn to Malaysia, where opposition leader Anwar Ibrahim saw his sentence to 5 years in jail for the crime of sodomy upheld by Malaysia's highest court on Tuesday. Speculation that the case against Anwar was politically motivated has divided Malaysia for 7 years. I sat down with CSIS Sumitro Chair Senior Fellow Murray Hebert to get his insight on what's happening in Kuala Lumpur. Why is Anwar Ibrahim seen as such a threat by the powers that be in Malaysia? And so why are they trying to put him away?
Well, you know, in the last elections in 2013, he took the opposition really very far in the parliamentary elections. They won just over 50% of the vote. But because of gerrymandering and because of the rural vote being counting a little more than an urban vote, they did not win the parliamentary majority. The ruling party still won. However, the ruling party has not managed to win back the ethnic Chinese in Malaysia, who make up about 25% of the population. They have not won back the urban vote, young people. And so I think maybe they were a little nervous and they wanted to get Anwar out of the way ahead of the elections when, you know, just a few percentage points can make a big difference. And ultimately, for the first time since independence in 1956, the ruling party faced the challenge of maybe being defeated.
And it certainly seems from the outside looking in that this may not be the most transparent process, that the judiciary aren't the most independent on this. Is that what people are seeing in Malaysia? How are they reacting to this?
Well, you know, there was a guy arrested today. He was a famous cartoonist in Malaysia. He's a political cartoonist. He walks along the edge a little bit. He was arrested and charged. They're assuming he'll be charged with sedition for tweeting that the judiciary was not entirely independent. He had a cartoon that showed the prime minister in a little box next to the Chief Justice and whispering what he should do before he gave the case. So that before he read his verdict. So that tells you a little bit about how it's viewed. It's generally assumed that in highly political cases like this, that the judiciary knows what it's expected to do. Nobody knows exactly how they get the impression, but they usually end up doing the right thing. So it's not viewed as an entirely independent judiciary at all.
And where does this leave the U.S.? Because I know we've upped our relationship to a comprehensive partnership with Malaysia. They're also due to lead ASEAN this year. Is it too delicate a situation for the U.S. to say anything about it, to highlight any of the problems with this case?
Well, you're absolutely right. The U.S.-Malaysia relations under Prime Minister Najib and President Obama since about 2010 have worked very hard to improve relations. Relations at a certain level have always worked at an economic level, even military-to-military cooperation was all under the military cooperation was under the radar. Prime Minister Najib wanted to be much more open and move much more closely to the United States. And then when Obama visited in April last year, they did announce the comprehensive partnership. As the chairman of ASEAN, the president was planning to, or there was a lot of talk in the White House about inviting Prime Minister Najib to come to Washington for an official visit. However, you can't imagine it'll be terribly easy for Washington now to bring him here. Officially, the U.S., the White House did issue statements saying that they are very disappointed. They say this raises issues about the rule of law, about the independence of the judiciary in Malaysia. And so really, it says in the statement, they say we want to improve relations. It's left hanging whether this really does make it much more difficult. But in the short term, it probably does make it more difficult because the U.S. does champion in the neighboring countries, Vietnam, Myanmar, countries that are in transition, the ideas of greater democracy, more transparency, and greater rule of law.
And does this at all damage Najib then politically at home, that the U.S. relationship may be in jeopardy as a result?
I'm not sure it really hurts him at home, except with the people that are already his critics. He has been under a lot of pressure from former Prime Minister Mahathir, who stepped down in 2003. He's now 89 years old, but he still has a loyal following in the conservative fringes of the ruling party. And he has been putting a lot of pressure on Najib on a lot of issues. I think it's possible that he will keep pushing now because he's seen that what crisis this has created for Najib, and that maybe he can push him aside. He withdrew his support from his immediate successor, Prime Minister Abdullah Badawi, and after he did a poor showing in an election, and it ultimately forced the party to get rid of him and bring in the Deputy Prime Minister Najib. He could try to do the same thing. Najib also he came in as a reformer, wanting to liberalize the political atmosphere, get rid of some preferential policies for the majority Bumiputra, the Malay population that make up about 60% of the country. He wanted to do this, but he, including get rid of a sedition law that dates back to British colonialism, he, instead of getting rid of it, he has in fact started using it an awful lot, and he used it on the cartoonist I mentioned a minute ago. In the last few months, they've probably hit about a dozen or so academics, journalists, other critics who have made comments that question the policies of the government. So he's really moved in a much more conservative way than it looked like he wanted to go when he was first elected. And that seems to have been because he's British educated, so he knows how the legal system should work in a democracy. But he's moved to the right, I think, to placate the right in his own party.
How do you think this Anwar verdict will then affect Malaysia's opposition? It seemed that Anwar was a guy who could bring disparate factions together and create a somewhat unified opposition. Is that now dealt a mortal blow?
I'm not sure it's a mortal blow, but you're absolutely right. Anwar brought together three disparate opposition groups, including a conservative Islamic party, a somewhat socialist Chinese ethnic party, and then his own party, which is more moderate and multi-ethnic. He managed to bring them together. He's a very charismatic speaker. I've seen him, I used to be based in Malaysia as a journalist, and I've seen him in the middle of a rice field in a rainstorm with 30,000 people standing there listening to his oratory. He's really good. He's a stem winder if you ever heard one. They now have to find a new leader. There are young people coming up, including his daughter, who is a member of parliament. She's a graduate from SAIS, Johns Hopkins, here in Washington. She's a little young, early 30s, but she's a rising star. There are others in the party. I think this will damage them for a while. They're going to have to figure out a new consensus among these three different groups, find a new leader. But I think, you know, eventually they'll be able to get it. Now, whether they can do as well in the next elections as they did last time, who knows? It may dent them at least for a while.
Murray Hebert, thank you for joining us. And that was Murray Hebert. Now on to our weekly leaderboard. This week, our Simon Chair profiled the U.S. Treasury Department's Undersecretary for International Affairs, Nathan Sheets. Dr. Sheets spent 18 years working for the Federal Reserve in their International Finance Division before serving as the Global Head of International Economics at Citigroup and holds a PhD in economics from MIT. In January, Sheets wrote on infrastructure investment and the role of the New Development Bank, commonly referred to as the BRICS Bank, and the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, the AIIB. Effectively Treasury's most comprehensive public response to date on the emergence of these two new Chinese-backed multilateral development banks. The United States had previously drawn criticism for alleged behind-the-scenes efforts to prevent its allies from joining the AIIB. Sheets reportedly sees many parallels between the problems he confronted as director of the Fed's International Finance Division, ranging from currency and financial stability to problems in international financial institutions and the Eurozone. Since his confirmation in September, Undersecretary Sheets has wasted no time weighing in on difficult issues. In addition to his discussion of investment banks in December 2014, speaking on Japan's role in global growth, he urged the reinvigorated application of all three arrows of Abenomics: monetary easing, fiscal policy, and structural reform. Keeping with the economic theme, we caught up with Scott Kennedy to analyse the latest developments surrounding foreign firms' operations in China, specifically a case and massive fine that the PRC levied against American tech manufacturer Qualcomm. We also discussed the USTR's announcement of a new WTO filing against China this week. Scott is the Deputy Director of the Freeman Chair in China Studies and Director of a new project on Chinese business and political economy. Qualcomm this week was hit with a huge fine, sure. Just under $1 billion for its practices within China. Is this going to be an impediment now to U.S. businesses, or is this something they kind of just have to take on the chin?
You know, if a $1 billion fine could be considered a slap on the wrist in the strangest way, this is in many ways a slap on the wrist. Maybe we'll go as far as saying it's a caning. But which is a type of punishment still used in some Asian countries, although not in China usually. But at the end of what's interesting is after the fine was announced, Qualcomm stock went up. And I think that indicates that, one, there was some anxiety about what the penalty would ultimately be and whether Qualcomm would be shut out of the Chinese market as a result, or what types of concessions they were potentially be forced to make. And what people were really concerned about was it going to have to hand over the technology within its patents and simply basically not get anything in return for them. And that's not what happened. They got a very significant penalty equivalent to 8% of their global sales, or sales in China in 2014, so $975 million. And then they had to adjust their licensing requirements for 3G and 4G technology, essentially a 40% cut in the price of what they had previously been charging based on, you know, outside estimates. Qualcomm doesn't typically advertise what its rates are, but this is our best guess is about a 40% cut. But it still leaves it in a very strong position. Qualcomm's technology underlies the global telecommunication system of every country. The CDMA technology, which it invented in the early 1960s, still is dominant across the board, even more important than Windows is to computers. So it's a big penalty. It affects its income per device, but Qualcomm is still in a relatively good position. But to your larger question, not everyone's Qualcomm. No one has the, most companies don't have the leverage Qualcomm has because they're not as significant. And so it does raise big concerns amongst the global IT industry, including in the United States. And that's why they've written several letters to the Chinese leadership and made representations in Washington. And the US government has also started talking to the Chinese about some of these new regulations the Chinese are considering. Which the Chinese say are generated by concerns over national security, which they think are legitimate given the revelations from Edward Snowden, but which others see as basically industrial policy tools. And, you know, there's probably a mix of both. And it's not surprising that we're seeing these type of Chinese initiatives. You always see them. And it's for American industry, this is a game of whack-a-mole, where something comes up like this and you have to respond. And when it's super serious, it gets to the White House, the members, top leadership in Congress raises it, and it gets dealt with. And we've had several of these over the years with the Chinese. I expect the policy initiatives the Chinese have pushed out, which are particularly onerous, will eventually be walked back. But you have to go through this every time.
If you agree with some people who kind of see a sinister, more sinister bend in this fine, in that it directly benefits a lot of Chinese companies like Lenovo and others, that then they're going to get cheaper rates and they're going to be able to, push out their products more. Or do you think this is, I guess, this is the Chinese government, this is a systematic thing, they're not going to stand for these anti-competitive measures, basically?
Yeah, I mean, there's China's usually never the best advocate for Chinese positions on things like this. There is a reasonable conversation to be had about IT and intellectual property and global competition policy. China is not the first country to bring a case against Qualcomm. The EU has, South Korea has, the Japanese have been looking at Qualcomm as well. And certainly when a company has that dominant a technology and has a licensing structure, which leaves it doing extremely well, Qualcomm is a quite profitable company. It's reasonable to ask to what is the appropriate balance between appropriately paying Qualcomm for all of the R&D and innovation that it's generated, that has benefited everyone, and the price that everyone else in the value chain pays and the choice that consumers face. That's a reasonable conversation. I think probably the way that the Chinese go about these cases means that the Chinese initiating the case because they are so heavy-footed about it, means that that part of the conversation is really lost, because you could just assume that the Chinese are trying to use this to their specific advantage without worries about the broader principles. But despite that, I do think that long term there needs to be a conversation about that, perhaps not just in the context of this case, but there have been waves of Chinese efforts in IT and telecom. In 1999, the Chinese issued regulations about software encryption, which were fought back in 2003 and 2004. They put forth new mandatory regulations about an alternative to Wi-Fi that they mandated, which was eventually rolled back. In 2009 and 10, they put forth these new policies related to indigenous innovation and government procurement, which were fought back. And this is just a new wave, and I expect it's the same pattern of Chinese pushing hard and then push back, and then they retreat a little bit. But it's not like they learned the lesson permanently. They're not going to go free market on this. So that's why companies have government affairs folks, and Washington is so relevant.
Right, and I mean, you talked earlier about how this fine that Qualcomm's under, 8% of what they made in China last year, about $13 billion or so, $13 billion, which kind of gives you an example of what the market is like there. This week, the American Chamber of Commerce came out with its survey of its members in China of what they consider about the Chinese business environment. What kind of stood out to you on that survey?
Yeah. The AmCham issues this survey every year. They issued it a little bit earlier this year than in years past so that it would get a little bit more attention before China's national legislature meets at the beginning of March. I think there's two big points. The first is that in general, American companies are still doing well in China. Over 70% still report being profitable with their China business. Particularly in consumer sector and services, which are expanding. But the second point is that the level of concern is rising, and it rose a lot in the past year, partly because of China's downturn in its business cycle, also rising wages in China and the difficulty they have finding talent. These are just really difficult problems that have only gotten worse. These regulatory issues, the fine against Qualcomm being just one of a series of steps the Chinese have taken, which people think have gone too far, far too blunt, not following proper procedures, even Chinese own procedures that they outline in their regulations. And so that combination has led companies to reconsider future investments in China, and a small number of companies are moving some of their business operations in China elsewhere. And the biggest concern is amongst companies that are R&D intensive in information communication technologies. So this specific case is part of a broader trend that is reflected in the data from these annual surveys. And these surveys are done year after year, and they are very similar, the results, to the surveys that the European Chamber of Commerce does and others. So it's not a blip. It's a very clear indication of growing worries.
And do you think that the Chinese are in any way worried about that? I mean, the American businesses are still making money, I suppose.
Sure. I mean, yeah, I think we need a little bit of context in that, you know, foreign investment in China in absolute terms is quite high. It was about $120 billion last year. China is the number one recipient of foreign investment in the developing world for many years running. But China is a very large economy. And so last year, surprisingly enough, despite the fact that it was the number one recipient of foreign investment accounted for less than 1% of total Chinese fixed investment for the entire country. So 99.1% of investment in China is from domestic, private, and state-owned firms. So it's no surprise that the Chinese lean toward helping domestic industry and state-owned companies in particular. At the same time, world leaders are largely Western companies. They have the best technology, best management practices, they are measuring sticks as well for Chinese. So the Chinese do not want to disengage from the global economy, and they need Western technology, management practices, and even financing. So they have to balance, you know, the various interests of, you know, what it takes to support the domestic economy, as well as make it so that foreign companies aren't so dissatisfied that they would just pick up and go. They have a little bit of wiggle room, given how big China is and its domestic market and how attractive it is to foreign companies. But if China's business environment continues to deteriorate from the perspective of these foreign companies, I think it'll be a new day where the Chinese won't have the leverage that they now have.
And continuing along the theme of U.S.-China business relationship, to take it on to the trade relationship this week, the USTR has lodged a complaint against China, with the World Trade Organization alleging that it was given preferential treatment for export companies. What do you think is behind this? Is there anything to it?
Sure. This is the 21st case that's been lodged against the Chinese at the WTO since they joined in late 2001. Every case that has been filed against the Chinese has been targeted at some aspect of Chinese industrial policy that seems to be inconsistent with China's commitments to the WTO, either things that they promised to change right away upon accession or that there were some phase in. In almost every case, the Chinese have lost. I think about 15 of the cases have been completed, and the Chinese lost, I would say, outright 13 of the cases. Two would call tie, depending on who you ask. Everyone always says they win a case at the end because they want their lawyers to be happy. But this case is just like the others. Relatively, in dollar terms, it's not a particularly large case. But USTR's history in deciding whether to bring a case is it materially significant? Do they have industry support from the U.S.? And what are their chances of winning? Will they win? Because they don't want to pay their lawyers and spend all the time. USTR is actually a relatively small organization. They don't want to lose. So they try to pick winners. And they've done a pretty good job so far. And this one looks like they have a pretty good argument, although the Chinese Ministry of Commerce responded this morning by saying there's justification for the type of support that they are providing to exporters in these special demonstration zones. So lawyers will argue about this for the next year and a half or so, and then we'll finally find out what they have to say about it. But I think there's both a legal reason for the U.S. to pick this case, but also we know that this is also a very sensitive time in American domestic politics because we are trying to, the administration is trying to get Congress to authorize trade promotion authority, and then which will be the foundation for then concluding the Trans-Pacific Partnership, TPP. Although China is not a party to TPP, everyone in Washington, particularly on the Hill, is worried that these type of international arrangements will lead to some types of concessions that benefit others and potentially the Chinese.
So it's the administration showing they're tough on trade.
Exactly. So they need to do this. And there have been some other cases that the U.S. has brought against China, which have been relatively small in dollar values, but were done with an eye toward the conversation in Washington as much as the, you know, what's going on in China. So I'm not surprised. I expect there could be a few other cases that we might see in the first half of this year. It's been a while, actually, since the U.S. had a new case against China. So I would expect that we'll see more so that the administration can demonstrate that it can walk and chew gum at the same time, that it's not just going to make a bunch of concessions for the benefit of a very particular part of America or for foreign countries, but it'll stand up for America at the same time.
Okay, Scott Kennedy, thank you for joining us.
And that was Scott Kennedy. To round off our podcast this week, we turn to our one to watch. The Oscars are being held next weekend to great fanfare, even across Asia. While it's no secret that the Academy is Hollywood-centric, for the fifth time in 6 years, no Asian picture made the shortlist in the prestigious foreign language category from among the 83 films submitted by 83 governments. This is despite China and Japan representing the second and third largest movie markets by ticket sales, respectively, not to mention India's Bollywood cranking out hundreds of films each year. While a Cambodian film made the shortlist for 2013, no Indo-Pacific film has won the Foreign Language Film Award at the Oscars since 2008, when the Japanese film Departures took the statuette. Before that, one has to look back to Taiwan's Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon in 2000 for the last big success. And although Slumdog Millionaire, set in the slums of Mumbai, cleaned up across many award categories in 2009, it was British made. An animated film from Japan and a short film from China did make the shortlist in those categories this year, but in all likelihood, Asia's film industry still has unrealized potential in the US market. And that's our podcast for this week. I'm Colm Quinn. Thanks for listening.